Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier here in KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. I'm your host, Bill Howell. And with us today for our interview, we've got Eric Slater, the owner of Seward Brewing Company. Eric, how are you doing today, sir?
Good, Bill. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. So, you know, I don't know how many of our listeners have had the opportunity to get over there and check you out, but for those that haven't, why don't you give them a thumbnail description of your operation there in Seward?
Well, we're a full-service restaurant and a brew pub, basically. We have, we're right downtown in the old Elks building that's been refurbished into our brewery and restaurant. We're literally like at the finish line of the Mountain Marathon race, so it's the perfect spot to check it out on 4th of July. The brew house is a 9-barrel system. We brew, this year we're brewing up to 8 of our beers this summer. We can do more. It's a 2-level restaurant, so we have an upstairs and a downstairs where we have chef-inspired pub food, a wood-fired pizza oven, and beers to match it all. And we're only open in the summertime, though. So we're a seasonal operation that goes from about May to mid-September on a normal season.
And are you open 7 days a week, or are you closed at all?
This summer, we're only open 6 days a week and for dinners only. We're closed on Wednesdays. Normally, in a normal season, we're open 7 days a week, lunch and dinner.
Well, that brings up the question about the elephant in the room. How are you guys handling the COVID-19 problems?
It's a terrible season, man. It really is. We started off like everybody else, you know, looking forward to a good season. And then as things progressed, we pushed our opening date back. We kind of realized that we need to look at our operation and make it more functional for, you know, the not being clear on the projections for the season and customers and visitors. So we looked at it and we kind of scaled it back to just doing dinners 3 to 9 with just one crew and staff. We did have a lot, you know, everybody hired up for the season, and a lot of people just chose not to come this summer. And so rather than trying to scramble for staff and keep those operating costs lower, we just kind of went for a core operation. So then we just kind of shortened the menu a little bit. And then we usually, in a normal season, we just offered counter service pizza and beer upstairs. Our kitchens are so small, it's hard to handle both levels. And so this year we kind of did full service upstairs and pizza and pub food on both floors. And it's working out really well. So I think we're going to stick with that concept a little bit more going into the future. But, you know, when we opened up in May 21st, we stuck with 50% capacity, staff wearing masks, sanitation practices every hour. And then we've been kind of maintaining that whole profile the entire summer. So,
well, I guess you guys have been fortunate. You haven't had any of the problems like your neighbors across the street there had, right? As far as having staff be positive for COVID and everything like that.
Yeah. So when the week before 4th of July, yeah, there was a little bit of an outbreak here. And so we did have staff who were out at the bars that week. Along with a couple other restaurants in town, we just shut down that week just so the entire staff could get tested. And we felt good about opening the doors. It turned out we were fine. But that really put a damper on 4th of July. I mean, we were looking at a really dismal 4th of July anyway. And that kind of put the hex on the town for that week. And then it just basically felt like a normal Saturday night in early May. It was bad.
So for our listeners who aren't familiar, why don't you talk to them a little bit about your background, how you ended up in this crazy business of trying to make beer for money?
I've been an executive chef in Alaska. Boy, since 96, I worked all over the place, traveled around cooking. Prior to owning the brewery, I was the executive chef for the Seward Winsong Lodge and Fox Island Overnight Lodge for Siri for 10 years. I did that. And I'd always been looking at opening my own place. And my wife had, you know, was a bar manager here at Ray's in town for 18 years. And we were looking at always doing our own place and looked at a few spots here in town. And we had an opportunity possibly to open a place in Juneau. And then this brewery just opened. Maybe it was only a year and a half old. And the owner approached me asking if I wanted to buy this place. And so... I always loved good beer and a good burger, and so I was all about it. And I came in and brewed with him a couple times just to make sure it was something I wanted to do. And I loved it, fell in love with it right away. And I homebrewed, you know, a bit, but always was attracted to brew pubs and breweries as I went out to eat and whatnot. So it was a natural progression for me to my wife and I to come in here and kind of take it over and stay in our community and do something good, and fell in love with it right away. And so I started brewing. So I understood that aspect of the business, and then I've had a few brewers in here off and on, but now I'm back to brewing, which I missed it terribly the last couple of years. So it's been real fun. And it was for creatively, it was really interesting for me as a chef to go into brewing. It's very similar in a lot of ways. It's the hardest part is there's no instant gratification with brewing. Like, you have to wait weeks to get that, see your hard work come to fruition. Whereas cooking, sometimes it's that day. So, and you're just open to a whole gaggle of new flavors and profiles and what this grain does and what that yeast does and those hops. And so it's been fun.
So why don't you describe your flagship lineup, what your different beers are like?
Yeah, so our biggest seller is our IPA, which is a big West Coast style. We call it the Pinbone IPA, and that's been our biggest pusher the last few years. The second one comes in is our Shark Belly White, pretty traditional white ale. This year we've got a Crusty Whale Pale Ale. We got a cult favorite, a local favorite is the El Hefeweizen, which is our roasted chili and caramel wheat Hefeweizen. So we use Anaheim chilies in it and roast them, so you don't get the spiciness, but you get the roasted chili flavor, and it just pairs really well with food. It's crazy good. We started doing a super hopped up, juicy, hazy IPA this year that's going over really well. We have our Inked Out Stout, our TK421 Imperial Stout, which this year we added some lactose to it, so we're making a milk stout, which I'm really excited about. We are playing around with a seltzer this year, which is going really well. And every year we do our collaboration with Bleeding Heart Brewing, which is always a crazy fun time.
Yeah, I saw they were just down there recently. I think it's on Facebook. Would you guys brewing this year?
Yeah, we did. We ended up, normally we kind of conceptualize it a little bit, but this year with the way things are, we kind of waited until they got here that morning, and we went down in the basement and kind of quick fire challenged the beer. It was fun. So we looked around at what we had and was like, okay, let's do this. And we'll add some of this. So we ended up doing a Imperial Pilsner. So we're going to hopefully get it up to like a 10% Pilsner. And we kind of lagered it for just a little bit at a cold fermentation for about the first week to see how it goes. So I'm excited for that one to come out.
That sounds good. When should it be ready?
Well, I'm thinking probably here we could start serving it in 2 weeks from now. And then those guys, when they open up the new spot in their new location in they think they were saying September, they'll have it on tap up there as well.
And I think I heard a couple of rumors that you might have some competition opening up down there. I know this year is probably not the year for it, but have you heard anything about that? I mean, I think there were a couple of licenses floated through. So
yeah, there's I know there's a license for a spot over on Exit Glacier Road, and he's got equipment in there. It's Salmon Bake, but I haven't seen any beer out of him yet. Looking forward to it. And then there's another spot on the highway here that's going to open. I think Fermento did an article recently on that spot. It's owned by a guy in town who owns a lot of places in town, a lot of restaurants and little hotels. So he's building a spot out there on the pond as well. And I think I saw the footings are in, but that's it about it so far. But I haven't seen any licensing for him yet. So, yeah, so it's, you know, business is still booming down here in Seward. There's going to be some folks coming in, which I'm excited for. I've always said I'd love some competitors come in. It just brings more beer lovers to town and ups our game a little bit and make sure we're doing the right thing. And we get more people coming down to Seward drinking beer. So yeah, it's good for everybody.
Rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, how about, why don't you tell folks a little bit about your menu? I've eaten there. I mean, I know how good your food is, particularly that poutine you make. That's excellent stuff.
Yeah, thanks. We do a lot of like fish and chips. We do fish tacos. Our burger is, it's on a pretzel bun. It's from Snake River Farms in Idaho. The beef, it's Beecher's cheese from Seattle. It's just an all-around great burger. And then we do a hot chicken sandwich, like spicy fried chicken sandwich. That's huge, popular chicken sandwich here. And then constantly doing specials. I have a gal running the kitchen, Sadie, who's been here for 3 years now. She's amazing and creative and throws down like chimichanga special for the night. We did a prosciutto poutine with rosemary fries the other night. So a lot of really good hearty beer drinking food. Our wonton nachos, which is basically a version of nachos using wontons as the chips and spicy cheese sauce with gochujang and lemongrass beef. So it's an Asian style nacho. We get a lot of our inspiration from traveling, going to different countries during the off season, coming back and being reinvigorated, re-energized, and we're like, oh, we could include this to the menu this year. We had some really good ideas this year going into the season, but some of it got nixed and stashed away for another year because of the lack of business coming in. But we're never shy of having some really good food and really good ideas.
Well, I can vouch for that every time I've been there. I think the food has been great.
Thanks.
Looking to get over, but evening in Seward is a kind of tough nut for me. I'm much more of a drive over in the morning, have lunch, and drive back. So
sure,
you may not see me this year. But anyway, well, hey, Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Is there anything else that you haven't mentioned that you want to make sure you tell our listeners about? You guys got any, I realize this isn't the year for it, but you got any events coming up or anything you want to give some play to?
Yeah, no events. We're just kind of looking forward to Salmon Derby coming up in August. I invite everybody to come down and see us and go fishing. And Seward's open, and it's great down here. And businesses are open, and we'd love to see everybody down here and come in for beer. Go check out the other places in town that are open. Come down, go fishing, camping. It's great right now.
Well, I'll second that. If you're in Seward and you don't stop in the Seward Brewing Company, then you're really missing out. So, well, thanks again, Eric. Appreciate you taking the time for us. Hang in there. Everybody's got their fingers crossed that we'll get through this summer, and hopefully next year will be a little bit better for us all.
We will. We will. And it's always great to talk to you, Bill.
Great talking to you. Take care. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'll be right back with our next segment. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. In our next feature, I'd like to talk to you about the art and science of the slow pour. It's said that good things take time. That is true when it comes to certain beers, especially ones that have been lovingly aged in tanks or barrels before they're packaged and ready to serve. However, once the decision to drink has been made, it's often a fairly quick affair. Bottles or cans are popped and poured into a glass. Tap handles are opened as the beer slides into a glass. Then you drink it. End of story. However, true beer lovers out there know that there is a great deal to be said for taking some time in that next to last step, the pouring of the beer into the glass. A proper beer pour should take a bit of time, hence the slow pour. The slow pour is a generic term for various techniques that can be used when dispensing a beer to ensure proper head formation. However, under that general term, there are many variants with nicknames like the 3-minute pour, the Stella Artois pour, or even a 7-minute pour. Stella Artois, the Belgian lager brand owned and distributed worldwide by mega brewer AB InBev, has even created a 9-step process, or should I say ritual, for pouring. Unfortunately, to quote their website, quote, most of the bars in North America aren't equipped with the proper systems to serve Stella using the 9 steps. So don't expect to see it everywhere you see Stella Artois on tap. If you would like to see it, there are plenty of videos on YouTube that demonstrate the 9-step pouring ritual. Charles Bamforth, the celebrated beer scientist and educator who is often called the Pope of Foam, cites Guinness as one of the best-known examples of the slow pour. When pints of the dry Irish stout are poured according to the brewer's suggestion, the whole process takes almost 2 minutes, 119 seconds to be exact, with the first half of that time going to building up a solid base of foam. Quote, what happens when you produce a lot of foam is that you're driving the proteins and bitter substances into the head, and when they get into the bubble wall, they interact and begin to stabilize the foam, says Bamforth. If you don't produce much foam in the first place, you're not giving the molecules a chance to interact. End quote. As the name would suggest, the key to a perfect slow pour and getting that fantastic dome of foam is to take your time with the pour, but Bamforth reminds us that you shouldn't be timid in the process. With a standard beer tap, it takes a vigorous pour down to the center of the bottom of the glass where the force separates the carbon dioxide, creating foam. Continually doing this will keep building upon that foam while the liquid drops down until you achieve the ratio desired. What you should avoid is the weak sliding down the side of the glass pour from a standard tap. That won't achieve the proper results. Quote, you want to see the beer splash into the glass, Bamforth says. There are other tap handle options, such as the side handle, which is more of a ball valve mechanism that controls the level of foam or liquid that is allowed into a glass. This is more common in parts of lager-loving Europe and is often seen around this country attached to a Pilsner or Quell branded tower. In fact, that famous Czech brewery often promotes various pours with increasingly dense levels of foam. Each different style of pour, tasted side by side, winds up tasting different from the others. Bamforth makes it clear that he hasn't done scientific trials to see whether the flavor of a beer is altered if it receives the slow pour treatment, but notes that, quote, the larger factor in play here is the foam and the psychology and beauty of it and the storyline the pour tells. Maybe there is a flavor difference, maybe it has lost a bit of its fizzy nature, and you get a mellower mouthfeel, depending on how much of the CO2 has dropped out of the solution. But I think the visual triggers are more important than the taste ones, end quote. Here, Bamforth makes an excellent point. After all, drinking beer should engage all 5 senses. You drink with your eyes first, so the beer just looks great when it's served, but equal to that is the mouthfeel. When you knock some of the set CO2 from the solution, the body is more supple and it volatilizes the aromatic compounds, and that provides a pop in the nose. Taken all together, this significantly enhances the sensation of consuming a beer. From a nitro pour to traditional CO2 pours to even cask ale poured through a beer engine outfitted with a sparkler, the slow-poured beer is dominated by creaminess. For the uninitiated, the idea of having to wait for a beer to be poured can be strange, but it really takes only from a minute and a half to 2 minutes for the beer to be poured and ready. If you're pouring beer from a bottle or can at home, you can use a similar technique for a nice slow pour. Pour the beer straight down into the glass, allowing it to foam and generate a nice head. When the head rises to the top of the glass, stop pouring and wait 30 seconds to allow the head to subside a bit. Then pour more beer into the glass until the head reaches the top again. Repeat this process until the bottle or can is empty, or you have about 2 fingers of head on top of your beer. For most beers, this process should create a nice stable head, which will persist while you consume it, leaving lovely lace lines on the side of your glass. While those who have regular access to these pours might swear by the value of waiting, it's unlikely the slow pour will become the default beer pour. Most people are not prepared to do this patient thing, says Bamforth. While that may be true, those people are missing out on one of beer drinking's real hidden pleasures, the joy of the slow pour. I'm your host, Bill Howell, with our final segment, Beer Gear. In this month's Beer Gear segment, rather than talk about some brand new gadget related to beer, I want to talk about one that's very old and very simple, the Lambic Basket. Much like the vineyards of Bordeaux and the peat-covered terrain of Scotland carry centuries-old wine and Scotch traditions, the region surrounding the Seine River in Belgium is steeped with one of the oldest beer traditions in the world, lambics. Until about 20 years ago, whenever the conversation turned to Belgian beer, lambics were typically drowned out by the mystique of Belgian Trappist ales. More recently, thanks to the global craft beer movement's interest in sour beers, this once dying style, along with its singular serving container, the Lambic Basket, has not only been rejuvenated in its homeland, but replicated the world over. Both brewers and beer servers have sought to maintain the traditional method of brewing the style, an ale brewed from unmalted wheat, malted barley, and aged hops that's spontaneously fermented via open-air vats called cool ships and then aged on wood for up to 3 years. They also have kept alive the practice of serving the style in its traditional distinctive basket. The two most common types of lambics that are served from baskets are fruit lambics and goose, the latter of which is a blend of 1-, 2-, and 3-year-old lambics. Both types are aged on their sides after bottling, where sediment forms from the yeast and fruit particles. Lambic baskets are used to keep the bottles as close to the horizontal as possible, between 20 and 23 degrees when pouring, to help prevent this flavor-altering sediment from entering the glass. While there isn't much documentation on the history of lambic baskets, it's thought that they were adapted from wine baskets commonly used in the French wine country for similar sediment-removing purposes. Given their proximity to wine-loving France, it makes sense that Belgians would start using such baskets for their sediment-laden beers. Like much of the pomp surrounding Belgian beer, or wine for that matter, the baskets also serve as a form of showmanship. They help set the scene when you're sitting in a cafe or serving beer at home. It's a great way to impress friends and add ambiance to a dinner party or bottle share. Nor does the use of such a basket need to be limited exclusively to Belgian beers. They work great for any bottle-conditioned beer that's been packaged in a 750-milliliter bottle. I use my basket often so as to be able to make multiple pours without overly disturbing the yeast that has settled to the bottom. If you're interested in obtaining a lambic basket, you may have difficulty finding one under that name, short of a trip to Belgium. However, most wine baskets are essentially identical, and you'll find a much better selection of them available online or at specialty wine stores. As beer gear goes, lambic baskets are relatively inexpensive, very decorative, and quite useful. Well, that's it for this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. Our closing quote this month is from that great science fiction author, Ray Bradbury. Beer's intellectual. What a shame so many idiots drink it. On that happy thought, until next time, cheers.
Home brew, any craft you choose. don't settle for the first, for it might be the worst. Cleanse your palate before you quench your thirst.
Beers of Alaska. Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers.